And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 8th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the author, teacher, and climate hawk, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Very good. And we're joined by the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, good. Good to have you both along, as always. So, last week, if you guys, people with long memories, it was about 7 or 8 days ago, we had a discussion about something called the Northern Pass, which, of course, is a brand name. But what it refers to is a high-voltage electric power line that was proposed to be built from Quebec in Canada across the White Mountains of New Hampshire and down into Massachusetts with the purpose of bringing clean hydroelectric power from Hydro-Quebec down into Massachusetts. Now, all very virtuous and green, or so the claim was. There was some debate, and what we talked about in our last show was the fact that the choice of this particular project as a way to get green energy for Massachusetts had some, it didn't quite pass the smell test because the people building the pipeline were also the people choosing, not the pipeline, the power line, were also the people choosing the power line. So it was kind of an inside job. But as of a week ago, Northern Pass had been chosen by Massachusetts for a 20-year, multi-billion dollar contract to build this high voltage line and provide us with clean electricity. And so, DR, I'm going to hand the baton to you and ask you to tell me what transpired soon after the state of Massachusetts made this momentous decision.
Well, the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee threw some sand in the gears of this proposal. They voted unanimously to deny a permit to Northern Pass. They basically declared that the power lines and the whole procedure of bringing the power would basically destroy property values and basically be a net negative for the region of New Hampshire. So it's something of a shock to Eversource, which basically proclaimed its disappointment and basically shedding, you know, the usual crocodile tears over the fact that they didn't get their pony, essentially.
Yes. And I mean, there was at the time a fair amount of, I wouldn't call it arrogance, but maybe hubris is the right word. They're saying, oh, yeah, those people in New Hampshire will approve our pipeline. No worries. The fix is in. So, Mariah, tell me, what do you see as kind of, I mean, what has been stirred up while the dust is in the air? What do you think?
So, you know, there's definitely, it seems like everybody wants transparency in this process, because as you said, it doesn't pass the smell test. Emily Norton from Commonwealth Magazine said that Northern Pass, when they were doing the sort of the bidding, that Northern Pass failed on nearly every criteria the projects were supposed to be judged on, including whether they enhanced reliability, if they were cost effective, if they brought, you know, economic and environmental benefits, if they made employment, and they didn't pass that. They weren't the strongest candidate. And so it's confusing why they got this. Well, it's confusing why they got it, except for the fact that Eversource was both on the selection committee. And as you said, they're benefiting from the building. You know, they're building the utility, so they'll benefit financially from selecting Northern Pass. So I think there's a big call for transparency, for some justification of why Northern Pass was selected. And notably, Maura Healey has, you know, wants the Department of Energy Resources to explain in writing to the public any decision they make about Northern Pass. So the Department of Energy Resources is supposed to sort of be overseeing some of this process. And, you know, I guess another thing Emily Norton said was, why are we not going all in on wind and solar projects that will create jobs for Massachusetts residents instead of this Hydro-Quebec?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that it's an interesting thing, and there's sort of this narrative story that goes along with this. There's still suspense in the air because Massachusetts granted this 20-year, very valuable contract to Eversource in the Northern Pass, right? A week later, the Eversource, the project hits this big bump in the road where the state of New Hampshire won't let them build that, and which means that the whole process goes into a court case in New Hampshire, right? And but here in Massachusetts, the whole process is in disarray because now the question is, what does the state of Massachusetts do? How do they make progress? And what I read said that given the fact that this, that the project has been canceled in New Hampshire, the responsibility sits with the three utilities in Massachusetts, that is to say Eversource, Unitil, and Avangard, or something, those utilities. They have to buy the contracts from Northern Pass. Right? So now the utilities have to put skin in the game and buy the contract from Northern Pass, given the fact that it might not get built, right? And I think one of the things Maura Healey is saying is that process now, which is in complete disarray, the state needs to step back in. And if this wonderful Northern Pass project is dead in the water, then how are we going to, you know, right the ship and get underway again in getting green energy? And so, I mean, that's a whole, I mean, you think the motion of government is somehow this grinding thing that happens automatically. But here, these guys ran into a brick wall, right? And so what is the state going to do now? They awarded the contract, but the very thing that they awarded the contract for, which was a rapid procurement of electricity by 2020, isn't going to happen anymore. Everyone knows that. Even if they eventually convince New Hampshire to let them build the power line, it's going to be 5 years from now.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the reasons, like you said, one of the reasons they selected Northern Pass is Northern Pass said, oh, we're shovel ready. You know, they had the hubris of this. Yeah, sure. It'll go through New Hampshire. No problem. But, you know, the court cases, I think I saw some estimates that court cases at best, fastest will be 6 months, for them to appeal, probably at least a year. So they are no longer shovel ready.
Right. And so then you come back to, so this is where Maura Healey comes in. All of a sudden, she wants to get her oar in the water and say, yeah, look, we're going to do it transparently. I want to know what the state's doing here. And I think, you know, as the Emily Norton piece is well said, is that the competition to the Northern Pass project, that is to say, when the state put out a request for proposals here, they got something like 45 or 46 different proposals about how to generate this electricity. Many ways that were closer to Massachusetts that involved solar panels and wind turbines and jobs here in the state. And all those got ignored in favor of this huge multi-billion-dollar program. And so the idea that somehow now the state stubbed its toe and has to go back and start handing out contracts to these much smaller but, you know, very good from a climate jobs perspective sort of local project. That's a good thing, a very interesting thing, right?
Do you know, Ted, were the other ones that were going up to bid, were they the same timeline, 20-year contracts, or were they?
I believe they're 20-year contracts. And I think some of the major other players were a electric power line that comes down through Vermont and already has the permits, in fact, is mostly built. I believe it's a somewhat smaller capacity to carry the electricity. And then there was a third power line proposal that comes across Maine and would come down. And those are also much, you know, they're pretty close to completion as well. It was certainly closer than the Eversource Northern Pass project was. And so those were the two big competitors, plus I think myriad smaller solar farm kind of things. And it's not clear who's going to win, but it is now sort of an opportunity to reinvigorate the process. And I think from a climate hawk perspective, the virtuous solution to this would be to have lots of jobs installing solar panels in Massachusetts. Right, that's what we want, to build our own industry, to have more offshore wind and have the Port of New Bedford and the Port of Fall River and all these four river up in Quincy busy shipping very long wind turbine blades out into the North Atlantic stuff, right? I mean, that's what you want.
At the very least, if they're not going to produce those, they need to tell us why they chose Northern Pass, right? Exactly. We need to at least know why they, you know, Baker thinks Northern Pass was the best company for the job.
And I think it's interesting because we are setting a precedent when we choose I mean, this procurement of clean energy and all of these things related to the Global Warming Solutions Act and the Omnibus Energy Bill, they're precedent. So we want to make sure that they're done with the right method and spirit and process, which, and that the right things get taken into account, which, as we've said now a couple of times, is local jobs and the local economy that makes the solar panels and whatnot. Of course, all the solar panels will be 30% more expensive because the Mango in chief has declared that. But that's a different story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I guess the Northern Pass story is one that is only beginning, right? We thought it finished last week, but it seems like we will be able to follow this now for quite some time. And for the people listening, that those are the stakes, right? That we need to have. We would like to get some of this hydropower, but I think I've read somewhere, again, maybe the Emily Norton, there's a bunch of articles about this, but Emily Norton was making the case that the Hydro-Quebec power is already in existence, so we can use it and deny, you know, by using the Hydro-Quebec power, we take the credit for the green energy, and then someone else somewhere else has to build a new wind turbine to make their own green energy, but it's it's not increasing the total capacity to generate green energy by buying the stuff from Hydro-Quebec. What we want to do is increase the capacity to make green energy here in Massachusetts, again, by putting up wind turbines and solar panels and all that kind of happy stuff. So, anyway, you heard it here first, right, guys? We'll be back.
Exactly.
We got a file. I got a manila folder right here that says Northern Pass on it. We're going to be stuffing little papers into that for the next couple of years, probably. So speaking of transparent processes and how we should be doing things when it comes to climate stuff, one of the, let's talk about the EPA and our friends at the EPA, Mr. Scott Putin at the EPA, as DR called him one time. There was an article in a Yale magazine, I think Yale 360 or something, right, that is about the ways the EPA is operating now. But just as, again, as backdrop to this article, everyone should know that dating all the way back to Robert McNamara in the 1960s, who was a Ford executive and came into the Kennedy administration as Secretary of Defense, he was a guy who brought in the idea of a cost-benefit analysis, that every policy you had to be a balance of, is the benefit that you get worth the cost you pay for it? And that has become ingrained into our government through and through. And in many ways, it's the right thing to do. You certainly want benefit for the cost, that for what you're paying for something. There's an underlying assumption that every benefit can be quantified in terms of dollars, which, of course, is a question that we can debate endlessly. But this cost-benefit analysis, where you put a value on the benefit and a value on the cost, and you look at the two and say, is the benefit better than the cost? That's a long-established process in the United States and has been used in the past to make calculations about should we have a clean power plant. So, Mariah, let me throw the ball at you. Tell me, what did the EPA say? What did that article in Yale Magazine tell us?
Yeah, well, and so just to kind of reinforce what you said, I had read that Ronald Reagan initiated the Directive for Cost-Benefit Analysis for Significant Policy Changes. As you mentioned, it goes back a long time, and it's rooted in conservative thinking that, you know, any regulatory action you do, the benefits of that regulatory action should outweigh the costs. And so Scott Pruitt and the EPA have been doing this sort of, like, economic voodoo to make some of these environmental initiatives all of a sudden, poof, they don't actually have the kind of benefits that they used to. And they're not doing it with science. They're not doing it with research. They're just basically throwing out the old science. Like, for an example, they changed the benefits from the waters of the United States, the WOTUS. And the way that they changed it is they said, oh, well, it's based on really old research, so we're going to throw it out. And they didn't look for new research. They didn't, you know, do any new research. They just said, yeah, it's based on old stuff, so it can't be true, which is not good methodology, to say the least. And of course, they're doing the same thing, you know, for the Clean Power Plan. The benefits were listed ranging from $34 to $54 billion, and the way that under Obama they figured out these benefits is avoided damage of climate change from some of the hurricanes, for example, we've been talking about, right? You have these hurricanes and it costs the government massive amounts of money in federal relief to sort of restore the cities that they hit. Mm-hmm. And then the other category is based on health effects. So there's these two major areas that they use to value the benefits. And essentially, the EPA said, yeah, those don't count. I mean, so you've got the EPA kind of on one side saying, yeah, no, we do care about, you know, air quality and people's health. And then they're throwing it completely out. The original valuation of the cost of a ton of emissions was $54 a ton, right? So if you price it that high, it means people, you know, or the externalities are a little bit more accounted for.
To make sure, so the $54 a ton is what's typically called, correct me if I'm wrong, the social cost of carbon, and is the valuation that is put on a ton of is the cost. Right, the penalty or the damage done by a ton of carbon is worth $54 per ton today, right? That's
yep.
the number.
And it's right, and it's priced based on, like, you know, the value of a life. What is the value of someone dying from, you know, asthma or heart attacks or hospital visits or, you know, all of these things that can be associated with mm-hmm. Basically not carbon dioxide, but the right. associated air pollution from burning fossil fuels. And the Scott Pruitt and the EPA dropped that from $54 a ton to $7 a ton, which is what, like an 87% reduction. So essentially what they're saying is that they don't care so much about the price of a life, about the price of a hurricane's damage on Houston or Puerto Rico. And what ends up happening is if you don't, you know, price these things ahead of time, then you end up paying for them significantly more down the road. So it's not a smart economic policy.
One of the questions I had is that they, so when I looked, I think at that article, one of the things it said was that the Obama administration, in determining the benefits of the Clean Power Plan, included the benefits globally of reducing carbon dioxide emissions here in the United States, as opposed to the cost. And so, of course, when they went to a global level, there is a lot more stuff that can be avoided, so you can claim much greater benefits, right? Did you see that part? I guess, one question I have is whether or not, it's called global warming for a reason, right? The carbon dioxide goes everywhere that we emit, and the carbon that China emits affects us. But the question, I'm just thinking in terms of cost benefit, is it fair to take a global benefit based on a local, I suppose it is, yeah, global benefit based on local emissions, right? Is that
well,
fair?
I mean, you know, if so, right. So if you get rid of, if you turn it and you say, well, we shouldn't be, you know, taking a hit for the damages of incurred globally from climate change
or something. Yeah, right.
Right. You know, who cares about them, right? That's sort of what it's saying. But we should care because, you know, when there are refugees, when there are wars, when there are, you know, global problems, those do matter to us. Those do come back to haunt us. And, you know, besides the fact that also just, you know, being a human to just sort of say, I don't care if all the Pacific islands go underwater.
Well, that's
right.
I don't
live there.
That's where the cost-benefit analysis begins to break down, because at some point there are things like, you know, the smile on your child's face that is not, you're not going to put a dollar sign on, right? And so how do you figure all this stuff out? Anyway, there's so much to talk about here. We've barely gotten through half of our gig list of things to talk about, but we got to put it down. So we got Northern Pass, the story that we're going to talk about for a while, and we have reinforced the idea that Scott Pruitt is a guy who should not be in charge of the EPA, and we'll just make sure everybody understands that, right? So what we'll do is we'll put up links to most of what we talked about on the blog. The blog is at massclimateaction.org/blog. You're able to listen to the SoundCloud version of this podcast right there. You can go to find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction and noodle your way through to the blog and the SoundCloud from there. Of course, the Mass Climate Action Facebook page has lots of other interesting stuff on it, not just the our podcast, so go check it out. You can listen to this podcast, though, directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, a bunch of other directories. You can find us on, I think it's called Apple Podcast nowadays, right? So Apple's new, it has the podcast service, a little purple thing on my phone, right, with circles on it. That is where you can find us. If you're an Apple person, you can find us on the, was it Google Go or something on the Android? Google Play, I think it is. So, of course, I don't have an Android phone, so I don't even know how that works. Anyway, we're going to close to where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the now one-year-old administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Mariah, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again real soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.